to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. As usual, I'm your host, William Hill, and this is November 14th, 2014. This is broadcast number 72. And today we have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Chad Van Dixhorn on a book and a project that has been something that he has worked on for many years, and I'm sure most of my listeners are familiar with the Westminster Project and the things that he has done with the Westminster Assembly and all the related documentation that centers around that event that happened all the way back in the mid-1600s. But we'll be talking with him about that subject, as well as a book that he has put out, Confessing the Faith, A Reader's Guide to the Westminster Confession of Faith, that was published by the Banner of Truth Trust, and we'll be speaking with him in just a few minutes. I do want to bring everybody up to speed on some of the things that are happening around Greenville Seminary. Obviously, the podcast, we have many guests lined up now going into the future and wrapping up this year. And if you want to know who those are, simply visit our website at confessingourhope.com. There you'll find all the information about coming broadcasts as well as ones that we have done. And that's the place really to go to get all the information. And, of course, in starting early this year, we're starting to think about the Spring Theology Conference. And this year the Theology Conference is on the subject of the law of God, specifically dealing with various issues surrounding that. And the title or the subject of the conference is The Law of God in a Lawless Age. We have various speakers lined up, Dr. Richard Barcelos, Dr. Mark Jones, Ian Hamilton, Dr. Pipe, of course, Dr. Tony Curto, Breno Macedo, who is a graduate of Greenville Seminary, and Dr. Sid Dyer and Dr. George Scipione. And they'll be talking about the subject of the law of God in various capacities and from various perspectives. And it's a conference that I think you'd really would enjoy and would like to attend. It's held normally in the early parts of March, March 10th through the 12th of 2015. And more information will be posted on the gpts.edu website here in coming days. But there is a basic information page there if you would like to find out more information about it. We're working actively at this, even this time, to try to promote the conference and talk more about it. And so on the podcast in future days, I'm going to be lining up some of these individual speakers to talk about their conference lecture and the material they're going to be presenting in a more formal capacity. So look forward to that in coming weeks here on the confessingourhope.com website. And of course, if you want to find out more information about the seminary, you can go to the website, gpts.edu. And if you have any comments or criticisms, yes, I'll take both. You can write me at confessingourhope@gpts.edu. Now, as I indicated, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Chad Van Dixhorn on the program today about a book that he has written and has been published by the Banner of Truth. It's the title of it is Confessing the Faith, A Reader's Guide to the Westminster Confession of Faith. Dr. Van Dixhorn has his MDiv from Westminster Theological Seminary, and that's in Philadelphia, as well as his THM, and he has his PhD from Cambridge University. So, Dr. Van Dixhorn, it's great to have you on the program to talk about this subject. I know it's a near, it's a subject that you've put a lot of time and energy, obviously, into, but it's good to have you on to talk about it.
Thank you, William.
Just up front, can you maybe, for the listener's sake, I would imagine most in the Reformed and Presbyterian persuasion, at least, are familiar with your work, but maybe take us through in a summary fashion is how did you get started working with the issues or the subject of the Westminster Confession and all the related material, and then how did that then branch over into the publication of this particular book that we're talking about today?
Yeah, thank you, William. I think when I was a seminary student, I was first asked to teach on the Westminster Confession of Faith at the little Orthodox Presbyterian church across the street from Westminster Seminary. And during that time, I became aware that a lot of commentaries on the Confession of Faith were helpful. I benefited from them. But a number of them used the Confession as kind of a launching point for the author's own particular views. And it struck me that we could probably use something that was a little more tethered to the text.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also think, William, that every generation ought to sort of own its confessional texts anew. And so that gave me an interest in writing a commentary on the Westminster Confession of Faith. So that was, oh dear, in the mid to late 1990s. So that was the first project I had in mind. And then to do that, I thought, if I'm going to say something fresh, I need to learn a lot more about the Westminster Assembly. And that's when I realized that research on the assembly had become a kind of a stale subject. People mm-hmm. citing one another, but not a lot of research was being done in original assembly sources. And so I ended up doing research on the assembly, and then later, during a postdoc in Cambridge, coming back to the confession, not using any of the material from the 1990s, but the original idea of writing a confession was a commentary on the confession was revived at that time.
Sure. Now you make the statement, and it's interesting to me and those of us in probably academic circles understand what you mean. But when you say own your confessions anew, what do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is looking at the confession and asking in every generation, is this a text that speaks to us today? Is this a text that's useful given today's church climate issues and concerns? I mean, this is what G.I. Williamson did so well for a previous generation. It's what others have done before him. And it seems to me that if our confession is going to remain a vital part of our church life, then we need people to continue reflecting on it in every generation.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's why we see the continual publication of various systematic theologies as well, because the church is constantly adjusting to various cultural issues and how does our systematic theology speak to those matters if we do, in fact, believe the Bible speaks to all matters of man's life. So we need to apply it to those particular circumstances. Now, certainly, when the confession was written, they weren't wrestling with the issues of abortion or other cultural issues that we find ourselves dealing with, but yet we can find in our confessions that we've held to for so long these matters and try to apply them. And I think that's very helpful, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because so many people that I've run into find sometimes when you mention the Westminster Confession of Faith or even any creed of any kind, they tend to turn off. And have you experienced that kind of reaction from various people?
Sure.
But why do you think that's the case?
Well, I suppose a variety of reasons. Some people think that a lot of doctrinal specificity can create a narrow and unfriendly spirit. I think that almost anything can create narrow and unfriendly spirits, and that a good confession, understood rightly, helps us have more material for doxology. So I'm in favor of creeds and confessions, and I like longer ones more than shorter ones. So it seems to me, William, that some people are worried about the narrowness of it all. It seems to me that other people want to have as few theological bullet points as possible, so that we can unite together as Christians for even more important ends than a doctrinal unity. And let me think of an example. I suppose if Christians want to federate and get together for political purposes, and if they see that being the highest end of the church, then they're not going to be too comfortable with doctrinally specific creeds, because it's going to hinder them from what they think is a more important purpose. So that could be another reason. And then you know that there are people whose creed is no creed but the Bible. I don't think that having a dozen bullet points on a website is usually enough for the church's thriving, for its mission not only to evangelize but also to teach the world. And I think a lot of churches that don't like creeds aren't really giving enough thought, perhaps, to raising up the next generation.
I think those are very good observations and helpful. As we've seen the church even change over the last 20 years, I mean, I've been alive 48 years and only been in the Reformed camp since the mid-1990s. I remember when I first came across the Westminster Confession of Faith. I never even heard of it before. And I was reading in Lorraine Bettner's book, The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination, and he kept mentioning, and I was so green, I kept thinking it was a woman that wrote the book. I mean, that's how ignorant I was. And I was corrected by a pastor. He told me, hey, look, that's not a woman, that's a man. I'm like, huh? Okay, so I was reading in his book on the subject, and he kept mentioning the Westminster Confession. I'm like, what is this Westminster Confession he keeps talking about? So I got a copy of it, looked it up online, and that was back in the day when the internet was nothing like it is today. And I was just absolutely just admired it. The language was so rich. It was so refreshing. It was so clear. It was concise. It was a great summary of things. And I remember saying pretty much out loud, where's this been all my life? Where has this been? Yeah. It's such a helpful thing to have, you know, in that bullet idea of I can concisely express these things that the Bible teaches on. Let's go back to your work on the assembly itself. How did that begin? And was it a team effort? Did you have people helping you do this work? And maybe talk a little bit about what it entailed. That's kind of an open-ended question, I realize.
that's fine, William. So the first thing that I did was to transcribe the minutes of the Westminster Assembly, which was a solo affair. Along the way, became convinced that it would not only be useful to have the full minutes of the Westminster Assembly published at some point. About a third of them had been published previously. But also, it became clear that it'd be really helpful to try and see what papers of the Westminster Assembly survived. And so it became a two-part project during my PhD. And then due to nepotistic hiring practices, Cambridge kept me on for a few years after that in the history faculty. And I was able to continue working, especially with the papers of the Assembly. And the Assembly wrote, I don't know, maybe 140 documents or something like that. Only a few of them are well known. And my job was to put together an edition of the minutes and the papers of the Assembly for publication with Oxford University Press.
Now, these are now, if memory serves, much of this is now published?
That's right. All of that is published, William, in five volumes, came out in 2012. What's still ongoing are critical editions of the Assembly's major works. So at OUP Prices, I didn't want to insert in this five volumes a full text of Larger Catechism, Confession, Shorter Catechism, and so on, with kind of critical textual apparatus. How do manuscripts compare to the printed text and so forth? So what we did is we've started a seven volume series with Reformation heritage books. The first volume's already out. John Bauer has created a wonderful, I think, the definitive edition of the Larger Catechism. Right now he's working on the Westminster Confession of Faith, and will also produce critical editions of the Assembly's Exchange of Minority and Majority Reports on Church Government, series for Church Government, Church Worship, and the Psalter, stuff like that.
Well, that's fantastic. The book you're referring to by John Bauer is The Larger Catechism, A Critical Text and Introduction. Yeah. I actually talked with him many years I shouldn't say many. When this was published, I think Yeah, 2010, shortly after it came out, published by RHB. I actually sat down and chatted with him on a different podcast on that particular book. So now I see how they all married up.
Yeah.
Now, maybe it would be good for the listeners. Again, many people who listen to this program are of the Reformed and Presbyterian persuasion, but not all. Maybe give a brief overview as to the history of the Westminster Assembly, and i.e., how did it come about?
Yeah.
What was going on, the climate, the culture, that kind of thing. And then we'll go from there into your work as it pertains to the Assembly, and maybe talk about some surprises, if there were any, in your research. Did you find anything that was that you weren't expecting? And maybe there's a lot of things. We don't have all day to talk about it, but
right.
There may be a few big ones.
So William, the history of the Assembly is really useful for us when we think about the relevance of the Westminster Confession of Faith today. Seems to me that one of the reasons for the continuing vitality and freshness of the Westminster Confession of Faith, it's kind of surprising relevance in the midst of the weirdness of English-speaking evangelicalism, is that it was written in such a turbulent context to begin with. The Westminster Assembly was called by the House of Commons and House of Lords in England during the early 1640s. There was a civil war going on, and one dimension of that civil war in England, and there was a civil war in Scotland as well. One dimension of these civil wars was religious, and to the extent that theology, church practice, worship, and government were causing those divisions, this assembly was appointed by Parliament to try and come up with some kind of a resolution, some kind of fix to the problem that both the king and Parliament and godly people around the country would all find acceptable. And so that was the assembly's remit. It also, along the way, examined thousands of ministers and ministerial candidates. It created a kind of a grid through which all incoming ministers needed to pass through, and anyone wanting to move from one church to another. So that took a huge amount of time as well. So it wrote a directory for ordination, directory for church government, and a directory for worship. All of these things intended to be texts which would address what the Westminster Assembly saw as an incomplete Reformation, something halted by Elizabeth and reversed by Mary, and then only lurching forward by small steps with James and so forth. The Westminster Confession of Faith and its 33 chapters was completed in 1646, and then scripture proofs were appended to it in 1647. As in my commentary, I take these proof texts really seriously, in that I see them as footnotes, often explaining what the confession has in mind in a particular phrase or sentence. I use them as a guide throughout to help enrich and understand the text of the confession. After the confession was written, two catechisms came out, larger and shorter, and then the assembly returned to the subject of church government until the king was beheaded in January 1649, and Presbyterians were opposed to the regicide. They weren't Republicans, and so they refused to continue attending the assembly, and Congregationalists and a handful of Presbyterians, I should say, kept the assembly going, but it was really reduced to a committee that examined ministers only until 1653.
I didn't know that. I wasn't aware that they continued after after they put the two catechisms together.
So it's about a 10-year event.
Interesting. Now, there's been some writing by various people as to the process the assembly went through in putting together the confession. When I first was introduced to the confession, I thought there were, you know, a bunch of guys in a room. They're all arguing and debating over these various theological issues, and they all took a vote and got an answer. But take me through the process. I mean, how did these 120 some odd men? How did they come up with, this is what we think about the Bible, this is what we think about God, this is what we think about the, you know, and so forth?
So they first started by trying to revise the 39 Articles of the Church of England. That task became less appealing when Scottish commissioners joined the assembly and did not want anything that smacked of an English or Anglican culture. And So the assembly then began to draft its own confession of faith. And what it did was to divide up topics to three standing committees. The membership of the assembly was divided into three. These were the standing committees, and they would assign different chapters to different committees. Those committees would come up with draft texts and report them to the assembly, and then the assembly would debate them phrase by phrase, line by line. If they didn't like it, they'd send it back to the committee and tell them to come back. But if they thought they had something workable, they'd debate each phrase or line until they had about a paragraph. And then they would go into a stage two of that debate, and they'd say, now, we've mentioned so many scriptural passages in our debates. What are the best proofs for these doctrinal statements that we've just voted? And so stage two is always the exegetical support stage, if you will. They weren't in theory supposed to go back and revise what they had written, although people would sometimes use that second debate, that second exegetical stage, in order to reopen a debate if they didn't like what the assembly had just voted. It was often chaotic. They'd have votes and then votes not to allow revotes and then votes to allow revocations and so forth. It could be pretty chaotic and time consuming. Then after they had these scriptural supports, they kept these, for themselves. When they sent up the confession finally as a completed unit to, Parliament, they did not append scriptural text because they thought that while the texts were useful for the assembly to justify what it had written, that they weren't self-explanatory. You had to know why a particular text was cited, and sometimes it'd be very obvious, and sometimes, as you'll know if you've looked at the proof text, it takes considerable thought. Parliament insisted that they append scripture text, so they went back and said, well, now we've got all these scriptural texts appended. Which ones are we going to, which of those will be attached to the published version? And so that took a little bit of extra time. The debates could vary from basic agreement amongst a majority to fairly evenly divided moments. Often there are many people there who just don't vote. It's puzzling. But you can have 80 people in a room and only 40 of them vote. That happens a lot. It happens a lot that people watch the voting, but don't participate. They'll even participate in the debate, but not necessarily in the vote. I don't know why. You wanted to know about interesting or surprising things.
Sure.
That's not surprising. Let me see. I think the first debate, which really surprised me, is the first one recorded in the minutes. The minutes kind of pick up abruptly in September of 1643. The first debate, oddly enough, William, is about supererogation. And
okay, you'll have to define that for our listeners.
Yeah.
And you know what? You'll have to define it for the host, too.
Happy to do it. Works above and beyond what the law requires.
Okay.
Supererogatory works are works that exceed the standard that the law of God requires of Christians. There's this odd but important tradition in the medieval period, develops in the medieval period, that's called evangelical councils. But not councils as in big meetings, but councils as in advice. Concilia Evangelica. Mm. Concilia Evangelica, these evangelical, you could call them gospel councils, are words of advice for Christians that you find in the Bible. So when Paul says, the Lord doesn't say this, I say this, not the Lord, but I, a couple times, they'll say, see, he's going above and beyond what Scripture really requires of us. He's letting us know how to add that extra plus to Christian life. When Jesus says, you've heard it said, but I say to you, these medieval theologians didn't think that Jesus was giving the heart of the law. They thought he was teaching people how to go beyond the law. And so when Jesus says, not only if you kill somebody, but if you hate somebody, are you committing a sin? They'll say, well, what Jesus is teaching us to do is to rise above and beyond the prescriptions of the law. These are evangelical counsels, gospel counsels. Be ye holy as I am holy. You see, that's not God's standard. That's a way of going above and beyond what's required of us. Mm. What happens at the Reformation is that the doctrine of supererogation, as something meritorious, something that the saints do, the idea that they've done above and beyond the law and that their good works can be credited to us, that's rejected by the Reformers. Christ's sufficient for all of this.
Right.
But exegesis changes sometimes more slowly than doctrine. And so even 100 years later, at the very end of the long Reformation, if you will, there are people inside the Westminster Assembly who still think that concilia evangelical councils is a good way to interpret those texts. They believe in non-meritorious works of supererogation, at least in theory. Well, that's pretty surprising. Even more odd, William, these ideas of non-meritorious works of supererogation don't seem to have any impact on their theology in any way. I don't see how it affects their preaching, their piety, anything really. It's just kind of an exegetical theory. But you have people at the assembly, a small minority, that defends this, and they're overwhelmingly defeated, and they move on. So there are really quirky debates. Every once in a while, you think you scratch a Puritan hard and you find even with a Reformer or a Puritan, a little bit of a medieval theologian in some of them. So that's my most surprising debate. Some other debates are edifying, interesting, debates about pastoral practice, debates about debates that reveal current practices in the Church of England and problems. There's my raciest story of the morning.
Yeah, that is very interesting, and I know that that's been a subject of discussion because in other theological areas there's been talk about what the original intent of the Westminster Assembly or the divines at Westminster were when they were arguing over various issues. And I know that some of those arguments have been there's been attempts to at least apply those to some very various theological unsettling aspects within the PCA. I'm not even going to mention the term, the phrase. Everybody knows what I'm talking about anyway. But setting that all aside, the makeup of the assembly. Some have argued that the Presbyterians have adopted the Westminster standards as their secondary standard, as of course only second to the Bible, because the makeup of the assembly was by and large Presbyterian. Is that a fair statement?
It's a fair statement to say that the makeup of the Westminster Assembly, by and large, became Presbyterian. There's a journey. People arrive with Presbyterian ideas, but they need to crystallize, form, and come to some kind of an agreement as time goes on. So there are committed Congregationalists. There are people on the fence. There's a few Episcopalians at the beginning, and there's a large tribe of Presbyterians, and the Presbyterians do hold sway in the end, yes.
Hmm. And why is it that, at least in your opinion, obviously studied opinion, that the Westminster Confession has really maintained its status, its stature, since it was written? I'm sure it had ebbs and flows throughout history, throughout time, but by and large, it's really maintained a pretty high place in the thinking, especially in the Presbyterian context.
Well, I think that the Westminster Confession of Faith and adaptations of it have compelled a lot of people to see its value, simply because it reflects Scripture so closely on the topics that it discusses. A confession is not a program for action. A confession can say something about the doctrine of God, but it doesn't tell us how to confront atheists. A confession can tell you that marriage is between one man and one woman, but it doesn't tell you how to engage in a culture that denies these basic ideas. But it doesn't need to. And so when people go there to find a summary of biblical truth and then are equipped by God to then apply that truth to their own context, they're going to be pretty content with the summary for a long time. I think it's interesting that the majority of Presbyterians are in the Global South. And they're using their translations of the Westminster Confession of Faith and finding it useful. I also think, and I alluded to this earlier and I suppose didn't really complete the circle of thought, the context of the Westminster Confession of Faith is also pretty interesting. We know that there's a civil war going on during the time of the Westminster Assembly, but it impacts the writing of the Assembly in some pretty profound ways. The existence of rival governments, the kings in Oxford and parliaments in Westminster, the existence of two governments doesn't make people twice as careful about what they print or what they preach. And so you've got a lot of unorthodox ideas and subversive notions about culture, which may have existed for a while, but which erupt during the Civil War, which I guess evidenced themselves during the Civil War. It's as if the lid comes off on the can of worms, and all of a sudden you find out that there are people who don't really believe in the Trinity. There are people who don't think that, who think that since the Bible's so clear, why do we need pastors anyway? A lot of the kinds of issues that we encounter in today's world and in evangelical subcultures suddenly evidence themselves in the 1640s. And then later, when Charles II comes back to the throne in the 1660s, the lid gets put back on the can again to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's something about the 1640s that is unique. It's kind of the wildest and wooliest part of English speaking church history until about the mid 1800s, when the Second Great Awakening introduces a lot of changes and raises a lot of questions once again. So the confession has a kind of, for those who are sort of recovering evangelicals, or people recovering from the worst of evangelicalism, you know, churches that are anarchic, that have no clear understanding of what they should be doing in worship, where leadership is abusive, they come to the Westminster Confession of Faith and just see issues addressed that their church wasn't addressing. They see kind of a level of sanity there that they appreciate. And I think that's one reason why people continue to use and discover with joy the Westminster Confession of Faith again and again.
Yeah, I've often said that when I'm teaching perhaps a Sunday school or whatever it may be, right now in our church we're going through the larger catechism, which I've often referred to as the redheaded stepchild of the Westminster, all the documents of the Westminster Assembly, because everybody talks about the shorter catechism and they talk about the confession, but the larger catechism, well, it's just too big to get your head around, so it just kind of gets set aside. But so we're going through it, and one of the things that I've often tried to impress upon those that patiently listen to me is that the Confession of Faith and its larger and shorter catechism is very pastoral in many ways, very helpful, very encouraging document. It's not just raw theology. It is that. It has that. But it's very helpful in a number of ways. I'm thinking about, you know, worship and the Lord's Day and the matters of that nature. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I do think that the confession often strikes a pastoral note. One only has to think of about chapters that discuss assurance, perseverance, good works. Many of the anxieties of a Christian are addressed there. The chapter that discusses God's character, chapter 8 on the work of Christ. These are all warm and doxological chapters. I think the distinctions that are made in the chapter on Christian liberty or the chapter on Christian worship are helpful. You mentioned its treatment of the Sabbath. I think that the Westminster divines could have enriched that chapter by pointing to the way in which the Sabbath points to our eschatological rest. I'm just so grateful for all the good things that it does say.
Absolutely. Now, some have referred to the confession as a compromise document. I've heard that thrown around. Do you agree with that statement? And if so, maybe elaborate on and I could probably try to explain what I mean by a compromise document, but I think you're probably in a better position to do that. And if so, as you're doing that, agree or disagree? Was it a compromise?
So I think it really does. I don't want to pull a Bill Clinton and say, what does yes mean?
Right.
But what does compromise mean? It seems to me that if one means by compromise, that the assembly was willing to wobble on some pretty basic issues in order to make peace, then no. But is there an extent to which varying views are accommodated in some places? Absolutely. But here's what I want to say. Discussions about compromise always assume something about intentionality, about motives. A lot of the compromise that happens, if you want to call it that, at the Westminster Confession, at the Westminster Assembly, is really a matter of negotiation. No one particularly wants to give ground, and they get the best that they can in a debate. Is that compromise? Compromise sounds like compromise assumes a kind of willingness. And I'm not sure, having read the Westminster Assembly's debates, that there's a lot of willingness on some of these points. Some people want to make a statement more bulletproof and they just don't get their way. Someone else might want more latitude. They don't get their way. So if by compromise there's any hint of an idea of doctrinal indifference, then no. If by compromise we mean that people who are not like-minded on every point. We're still able to work together and produce a text together, then yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, anybody that serves on a session today understands that idea. They're not always going to get their way, but they're able to work together to try to come up with some kind of tangible way forward.
And I'm not sure that working together is best characterized as compromise.
Right.
I'm not sure that collegiality is best characterized by compromise.
Right.
And what we see is some pretty robust collegiality at the assembly, a willingness to stick together, even when the going gets tough. Now, mind you, these people are not really there voluntarily, right? They've been summoned there by Parliament. So, to draw a direct line between their willingness to stick together and our willingness to stick together in the presbytery is historically anachronistic. It's a bit of an odd parallel. I mean, these people are there in part because this is their big chance to try and shape their church for the future. Not just because they're big-hearted and can put up with a lot of differences between themselves.
Mm. Interesting. Now, you mentioned there were various views that were accommodated. Can you give a couple examples of that?
Well, let me have a think, William.
Sure.
And as before, if I think too long, you can fix this problem as you edit this.
Right.
I want to think of a good example. My mind's running a little slowly this morning. Okay, I've got one. You can pick up recording here.
Okay.
One example, William, would be the question of hypothetical universalism.
Okay.
I do not think that the Westminster Confession of Faith allows for hypothetical universalist readings. Let me tell you what I mean by that. There are people who contend that in God's plan, Jesus dies for everyone, but the Holy Spirit only applies that work to some. The work is hypothetically universal. Christ's atoning work is only hypothetically universal because God all along only plans to save his elect. And there are very subtle nuances of this view in the 17th century. As I think about the Westminster Confession of Faith and the way in which it crafts its statements, there are a number of places, there are a number of topics where it could have more explicitly denounced a particular view. But I think of the confession as something like a limousine with bulletproof windows. It's not an armored car. If it was going to be bulletproof against all error, the text would have to be much more clunky, heavy, intricate, filled with technical words and denials and assertions. But it's not that. Nor is it an open-top convertible, as some people would.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't make of it whatever you will. It's pretty definite in its teachings. You know what? I'm going to can all of that, what I've just said, because you didn't ask me. I'm answering the wrong question. You asked me for an example of compromise.
Oh, but that was very good. I mean, especially because the idea.
Yeah, but I'll be happy to say that in answer to a different question.
I don't know. I don't know what the question would be. Kidding.
I can give you that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. But first, let me answer your first question.
Okay.
Which is an area of potential compromise. Okay. I'm ready to go again. Sorry about all this.
Sure. That's okay.
One area of potential compromise has to do with millennial views. I think the final chapters of the Confession drift towards a most naturally all millennial reading, but there are those who believe in a 1,000-year reign of Christ at the assembly, And there's no attempt to shut that down. You just don't see any negative statements about that subject at the Westminster Assembly or in its confessional standards. That would be just an easy example of a compromise.
Sure. Now, but that raises an interesting question that I never considered until just now about the way the confession was put together. I mean, we have 33 chapters.
Yeah.
We start with Scripture. Great. That's where it should have started, and fantastic it started there. But did they deal with these subjects in that order, or did they deal with them different orders, and then they put them together in a more obvious way?
Pretty much this order. Pretty much this order.
So they dealt with Scripture first, and they dealt with God second, and moved on from
what
there.
What they'll do is they'll assign a cluster of chapters to a committee. That
I
committee will report back on whatever chapter it's ready to discuss first. But there's a rough drift from beginning to end, yes.
Well, the reason I asked that question is because you mentioned the end of the confession, and I just wonder, I mean, I get tired. I just wonder, did they get to that place in the number of years, obviously, they're dealing with these issues, and did they just say, we've debated ourselves to death, we're tired, it's time to go home, kind of. I know maybe it's a crazy question, but
No, they don't seem to have run out of steam quite yet. Not at that point. No.
Okay.
There is a logic to the way in which the confession moves. It starts with its most broadly, it starts with the basic assertion that there's a story here and there's a storyteller. So there's God, His Word, His eternal plans. You've got your first three chapters on Scripture, God, and the decrees. And then you've got the story itself, the fall, the effects that the fall has on us, God's saving plan, the covenants. Then you get to the mediator and His work and how that impacts us. And then how we're incorporated into the church, how we're blessed in the church. Sacraments and so on, and then we move beyond the church as the Christian engages the world. We have marriage and the civil government, and then we end with the last things. So there's a basic narrative flow, even in these very doctrinal chapters. Why did I say that? I'm not sure. Something made me think that was relevant at this point.
Well, I think I asked you how how did they go about putting this together, this final product? And you had indicated that they just took them as we have them.
I love it when someone can make sense out of me. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah. No, it's maybe I'll reveal my thick-headedness a little bit, but I never considered it quite that way before. I've read the confession. I just read it wherever I am, and never really related the parts before the chapter I'm reading and the parts after the chapter I'm reading, but they go together. There's a context and there's a reason.
They do, and there's also a way in which to look at how they come together in a systematic way, too. But that idea was suggested to me last night. Reformed Theological Seminary, where I teach, had a colloquium on the Westminster Confession of Faith, and I borrowed that from a colleague. I'd give him credit if I could remember which one of them said it. So, William, you mentioned earlier the question of compromise. I'd also say that there are places where the assembly hasn't compromised, but also hasn't shut down error as loudly as it could. Let me give you a metaphor. Some people think of the confession as like an open top convertible,
right.
Where almost anything goes. And others wish it were something more like an armored car, excluding every possible heretical attack. I think of it more as like a limousine with bulletproof windows. The assembly tries to avoid error, so it's not an open-top convertible. But it doesn't do so in kind of a heavy, clunky way. It could have used many more denials, many more technical terms. I mean, if it truly wanted to be blast-proof, a heresy-proof, it could have done more. But they were trying to create a text that was also readable. that an average person could understand without wondering, now, why is that here and this here and that there? Let me pick the subject of hypothetical universalism as an example. Hypothetical universalism is the idea that God the Father sent his Son to die for everyone, but only sends his Spirit to redeem some people. There's a kind of Trinitarian disconnect. There are other issues. There are very subtle versions of hypothetical universalism that are available in the 17th century. I believe that the Westminster – and this subject is discussed at the Westminster Confession of Faith. At the Westminster Assembly. I think that the Westminster Confession of Faith could have been made more bulletproof on this subject. It could be heavier, clunkier. It could proscribe that idea more clearly. But I do think it's clear enough. And that if you take sentences together and not apart, then let me be nerdy here and give an example. Chapter 3, paragraph 6. If it's read with paragraph 7, precludes hypothetical universalism. If you read these two chapters together and not just apart, there's no way that you can have a hypothetical universalist reading your Confession of Faith. It bans the idea. It basically says whatever Jesus Christ accomplished, he also applies to his elect only, and everybody else falls into a different category. That might be kind of arcane, but I think it's useful to have kind of an overall understanding of what they're trying to do and what they care for when it comes to speaking truth and prohibiting error.
Sure. Well, I promised you I'd get you off here within 60 minutes, but I do have to ask this one question, and then we'll talk briefly about the particulars of the book. I mean, we talked all around it, I think, in some capacity. Good. But I'm an American, obviously, and I'm an American Presbyterian. And I'm going to get an F now in church history because I can't remember the exact date when the American Presbyterianism adopted the Westminster Confession.
Yeah.
But they revised it. They changed it.
1788.
That's it.
And they published their changes in 1789.
Do you think those changes were good, bad, or indifferent?
Oh, no, I think they're good.
Interesting. Why?
I think the Westminster Assembly makes one large mistake, and that is that it identifies Israel and the church, but it gets Israel in the wrong period of its history. It seems to think about Israel as if it were in the promised land. And the church is not Israel in the promised land. The church is Israel in exile, in the wilderness. And so when the Westminster Assembly tries to argue that the civil magistrate has religious duties to lead and to guide the church, much like Israelite kings and judges did when they were in the promised land. That's a category mistake.
Was that possibly born out of the fact that the Westminster Assembly was sort of in the middle of that themselves?
It's born out of the fact that everybody thinks that way since Constantine till about 18, till the 1700s.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Now, of course, they also had the whole issue with the Antichrist.
Yeah, I mean that is part of a worldview that perceives of Roman Catholicism as enemy number one, and that view thrives in the church right into the 20th century, all throughout the 19th century, there are sort of annual anti-popery sermons and so forth. And there's real utility in seeing the danger of the teachings and the model that the Roman Catholic Church sets forth. I think the reason why the the church eventually, Presbyterians eventually, for the most part, have removed the designation of the Pope as the Antichrist, is because that's too specific an interpretation of a passage that allows more than one reading.
In the original assembly, it was very specific, right? It was the Pope is the Antichrist.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, and I've heard people try to reason around that by saying, well, he is an Antichrist. I'm like, yes, but that's not what it says.
No, it's not what it says.
Yeah, and I've always felt that that was not being faithful to the original documentation, that they really meant that the Pope, the one sitting in Rome, the one in the Vatican, he's the Antichrist.
Yeah.
And it's not a question of he is an Antichrist. I don't think any Christian would disagree with the fact that he's opposed to the work of Christ. Whether he understands it or not is another subject. But fine. I mean, that, if that's what it said, I'd have no issue. But that's not what it says. It says the Pope is the Antichrist, that, i.e., that man of perdition, that man of sin. That, you know, and I, that's where I have the problem in that, trying to articulate it that way, because that's not, I don't think that's what they meant. And you would say that's true. They meant the guy in Rome.
They meant the guy in Rome, and now you've got that off your chest.
Yeah, I feel better. A whole lot better. Let's talk briefly about the book.
Yeah.
We obviously talked around it, and we've laid a really good foundation of why people should read it. You've talked about we need to always look at our confessions from new sets of eyes, new perspective in our cultural milieu that we find ourselves in, and find the value in it there. And that's very good. And hence one of the reasons why the book, I think, was written. But what's your goal? I mean, what are you hoping to accomplish?
So, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Okay.
So I had a personal goal. I wrote the confession while I was at Cambridge, working on the minutes and papers of the Westminster Assembly. Those minutes and papers, on the whole, are not inspirational documents. And I wanted something to feed my soul a little bit more than the minutes and papers do. And so I began giving expositions on the confession at Cambridge Presbyterian Church, continued that when I moved to Vienna, Virginia, where I am now, just outside D.C., at Grace Presbyterian Church, did that on Sundays here, and then completed it in order to give lectures at RTS and elsewhere. I found that reading a paragraph and thinking about the biblical basis of each doctrine and how it can lead to praise of God or reform of life was very useful. So it was that personal reason. And that kept me going on this project for some years until it was brought to completion. And then, William, I suppose I am concerned that that a lot of documents, that a lot of church statements of belief are too short and mm-hmm. too bland. You know, God is just, you know, point one or two on the outline, but he doesn't seem to be anything to be praised. And so I want to help people see how this confession is biblical and how it gives us sort of rich material for praise of God. And and so I hope that tone is communicated in the book. It seems to me that if I'm writing a commentary on a book by Puritans, it ought to have a little bit of that, the best of the Puritanical spirit leaking through from time to time.
Sure.
And then also I wanted to try and write something that would be clear enough so that any teenager or adult would be able to understand what it's saying. They may need to pull out a dictionary every once in a while, but something which lays out the breadth of the teaching of this confessional text with real clarity. So that's another thing that I at least attempt.
Yeah, well, I think it's well done. And I can't think of somebody else that would be in a better position to do what you've done with this volume, which you know, in some sense is probably short. It's 484 pages if you consider the index.
And omit the introduction. I like that.
And it's put together very well. I'm talking about just the substance of the material. The book is put out by Banner. I heard somewhere that they do their hardcovers so that they last 100 years. I don't know if that's true or not. I've heard that. I don't know who told me that. Somebody who knows something, I guess.
Better books to read in 100 years on the Westminster Confession of Faith.
Yes, but if you buy it, it's going to last. It's not going to fall apart and be of no your pages flying all over the room at some point.
Hey,
but
they've done a great job.
Yes, and it's and you know, in thinking of that, have you received any feedback at all from others as far as the book is concerned? Good, bad, or indifferent?
Yeah, people have been very kind, William.
Yes, well, I hope so. They ought to be kind, at least kind. But that's good. I mean, it's I can see this actually as I mean I have it sitting right here on my my table, and you know, find myself leafing through it and reviewing things, especially as I'm teaching through the larger catechism, trying to, you know, get some more insight and understanding on a document. I think you could study your whole life and still never completely master. There's just so much, as you said, rich doxology contained within it that, you know, you just don't ever get to the bottom of it. And it's just a splendid document that God in his providence put together in the 17th century. And we're still, as a church, feeding on that in today's world. That's got to say something all by itself. So anyway, well, I really appreciate you, your time and the labors you've put into this project. You mentioned the five volumes. Now, who publishes that? Those are the minutes of the assembly?
Oxford University Press. If you sell a child or your latest car, you should be able to afford that.
Yeah, you know, I wish I could. Yeah, so, well, we won't talk about that. But, yes, if you're interested in that volume of work, you can Google it, Amazon, or wherever. You'll probably find it pretty easily. But as my guest has said, it's not cheap either. So, but be that as it may, it may be worth it to if you really want to dive in into the deep end, as it were. But if not, then I would encourage you to get this copy put out by Banner of Truth. Just go to their website, banneroftruth.com, and it's there. It's available. It's just recently released, I think. Well, it's copyright 2014, but I know it came out not too long ago.
In the summer, the end of the summer. Yep.
And I just got my copy not too long ago myself. That was redundant. But anyway, I would encourage you to at least get this. And if you have other commentaries on the confession put out by guys like Hodge and I forget the other guys, so forgive me. But, you know, to supplement this, this is fantastic, up-to-date, as we've talked about already, looking at the confession anew with fresh eyes and our generation and our culture and the things that we're dealing with in the church. But especially if you're an officer in the church, in the Presbyterian context, I mean, you've taken vows to submit to the Westminster Standards. It's a fantastic way to stay abreast and familiar and revisit these things that you said you would uphold as an officer in the church. So I would strongly commend it to anybody, but especially those who are who have taken vows to uphold it. So, but Dr. Van Dixhorn, I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy, and I told you 30 minutes to an hour. I think we've bumped up to the hour. It's amazing how that happens in conversation. But I appreciate your time and your labors and your work in the church, and I trust and pray that this will be very beneficial and helpful.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, William.
Absolutely. Hang on the line just a second while I wrap things up. I just want to, again, reiterate to everybody, if you're interested in the Spring Theology Conference put on by Greenville Seminary, it's every year. Go to our website, gpts.edu, and you can get all the information related to the conference right there. And that page will be updating as we get closer and closer with more and more information in relation to the conference. So until next time, when we sit down and talk with Peter Barnes, I'm going to be speaking with him all the way from Australia. Now, I won't be in Australia. I'll be here in the States, but he'll be in Australia, so which means you do the math and the time and everything. It's been really interesting trying to get that all coordinated. But I'll be speaking with him on a document that he released that was also put out in the Banner of Truth magazine, the monthly publication of the Banner of Truth Trust. And so we'll be speaking with him on a particular article that he wrote, and for the life of me, I can't remember the name of it now. So, well, anyway, go to the website. You can get the title there. So until next time, we thank you for listening to this particular edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. And God bless.